This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
That brings me to our talk today, which will be, I haven't heard the talk before, so I'm looking forward to it at least as much as you. And following our tradition, I will give as short an introduction as possible. If you haven't met him already, you're about to have the treat of meeting a relatively new colleague of ours, Adam Samaha, who's sitting here to my right, whom you'll meet shortly, and he will in fact take your questions and I'll get completely out of the picture. Adam has been in our faculty for several years now. He is also the Freed Research and Teaching Scholar at the law school. He has quickly become one of our most beloved teachers, but also one of our most ferocious, which is a compliment, faculty roundtable participants and workshop participants. And he's just a total treat, and no subject is beyond his interest. And that's what I found out about Glocks when I looked at his title. So without further ado, I give you Adam Samaha.
Okay, thanks for having me. I'm not going to promise you a high-quality speech today. I ordinarily teach the First Amendment. I've been taking the amendments in numerical order, so... This is really my first shot at the second. Let me just try to put the court in context a bit. Last term, we had some new faces at the court, but they were essentially asking and answering old questions. So there was some movement, some substantive movement, but I think it was rather moderate. And in terms of major change, I think you want to look for new questions. So last term, we had cases involving partial birth abortion. That was just really a retooling of an earlier ruling that the court had already confronted. We had questions about campaign finance reform. We had questions about racial assignments in the schools, and none of those were terribly surprising cases. None of those ripped to shreds old precedent, but they did make movements. They made some movements. This term, though, I think there is a new question, at least if 70 years of silence from the Supreme Court generates novelty. There is a new question, and it's about the Second Amendment. I want to start first with a fact that I've puzzled over a little bit, and it's this. There are a lot of amicus briefs in the case that's before the U.S. Supreme Court, District of Columbia against Heller. It generated a lot of attention, so lots of organizations and academics want to put their two cents in, but there's one brief that I think stands out, and that's a brief on behalf of members of Congress. Now, this isn't odd in and of itself. Members of Congress often want to sign on to amicus briefs to state policy positions in their own sense of law and even constitutional law, so that alone isn't very interesting. But what is interesting is about the numbers of the members of Congress who signed on to this brief. 55 from the Senate and 250 from the House of Representatives. Now, when I was in school, I liked mathematics a lot. I wasn't very good at it, though, but I'm good enough to know this, that 55 in the Senate and 250 in the House ordinarily gets you legislation. Legislation, in other words, to change the District of Columbia ordinance to eliminate the handgun regulation that's at issue. Now, of course, there is a filibuster to inhibit that effort, but it's not clear to me that that's the real blockage. So there was a preference on behalf of these politicians to litigate and not vote for legislation, and I want to know why. Now, one possible answer is that Congress is so irredeemably, dismally screwed up that it ought to disband. And I'm open to that possibility. That might be the right answer. But there are other answers, too, which I hope to explore very briefly at the end of my remarks. So let me tell you about my remarks. Here's what I'd like to do. First, I'll just make a few brief comments about the case before the court, D.C. against Heller. and I'll make some predictions, which is dangerous, but you'll probably forget them by the time late June rolls around. And then I want to talk about the future. The case is going to be a lot about the past, but I want to think about constitutional law, in particular Second Amendment law, in 2028, 20 years from now. Is Saul going to have Constitutional Law 6 just for the Second Amendment and what that might look like? And then from there, talk a little bit about what functions or roles we can think about the court playing more broadly. Okay, so first about Heller, it's relatively simple. Now, it's an atypical regulation under challenge and in an atypical location. D.C. is a federal enclave. But the core of the challenge is to a handgun ban. It effectively bans handguns for most people. If you had a handgun in 1976, that's one thing. But after that, with a couple of exceptions, no permit is going to issue for a handgun. And beyond handguns, other firearms are also regulated fairly heavily as well. The district says if you have any other firearm, even if you can get a permit for it, it's got to be either disassembled and unloaded or have a trigger lock or other similar device on it. Now, that provision's a little bit ambiguous, but it sounds like the district wants to read that as you've got a choice. You can disassemble and unload, or you could leave it loaded and assembled, but you got to have a trigger lock on it. And that's for any firearm, not handguns. It's just hard to get a hold of, legally anyway. So Heller wants strict scrutiny applied to this regulation. He wants it knocked down, but really he's asking for something more modest. He wants to be able to possess a functional firearm. The precise meaning of that is a little ambiguous, but a functional firearm in his home. He's not arguing for a concealed carry or those other things. Okay, he just wants to keep a handgun in his home for self-protection. Well, how did we get here? How did we get to this point? Because before 2001, there was essentially no movement in federal constitutional law in the federal courts on the Second Amendment. There was just no movement. Nothing happened. In 1939, the court had sent a kind of negative message about the scope of the amendment and then fell silent. And the lower federal courts had not done anything interesting until about 2001. Now, why? Why the change? Why the controversy now to the Supreme Court? Well, there was a lot more energy going on in other locations, both politically and legally, at the state and local levels, and to a certain extent, federal legislation as well. And this was an amalgam of forces. I'd like to point out legal scholars first. Maybe that's a self-love problem I have. But legal scholars, this was one part of the movement, in particular left-leaning legal scholars, at least those who are perceived that way, like Lawrence Tribe and Sandy Levinson of Texas, who had indicated that the case for individualized Second Amendment rights, not affiliated with a militia organization, that case was stronger than maybe we had anticipated. Maybe the Second Amendment doctrine ought to look a little bit more like the first. I think that was probably not a big force in the change, but what was important was a social movement, a strong social movement, a kind of gun rights culture that is not just in rural areas, although quite strong there, but in other locations as well. And as well, the NRA and other organizations, collective action organizations that had organized both to litigate but also to get movement on the legislative front. And they had several victories. And there's some evidence of this, not just legal victories, but also cultural and broader political victories, if you just think about the last several presidential election cycles. So going back, way back to 1988, I'm a big fan of the 80s for reasons I can't fully explain. But in 1988, you might remember, Michael Dukakis selected Lloyd Benson as his running mate. And one of the attacks on Dukakis was, well, this pointy-headed intellectual from Massachusetts is going to take my gun. And Lloyd Benson was from Texas, and so he had a southern drawl. This apparently helped. And he'd say, well, I wouldn't be on the ticket if anyone was going to take my shotgun away. So it was important to defend on this front, and maybe this was something Al Gore didn't understand. understand. His idea was, well, I can gin up the gun control forces, and they will equal or overwhelm the gun rights forces, and many people think that that was wrong. So in 2004, you see the response from John Kerry. You see him in hunting garb and a rifle, and he's shooting all over the place. And now, the current Democratic candidates, you hear Barack Obama, our own Barack Obama, talk about an individual right to bear arms. So although the NRA is often considered like an affiliate of the Republican Party, that's not quite true. They cross over and also affiliate with Democrats as well. And the political culture is such that it's very hard to take a hardline anti-gun rights position if you're not living in urban America. That's a risk. That's a risk. And I dug up this Gallup poll from 2007, and it reveals this. 68% of respondents opposed a flat handgun ban. 68%. You want to know what it was for those with postgraduate education? 60% opposition. For women over 50 years old, 57% opposition. There's really no group other than liberals, and very few people want to self-identify as liberals, so you're down to like 15 or 20%. Yeah, you get like 54% support for flat handgun ban. Okay. Still, there are significant gaps in the gun culture's political power. In urban areas and in suburban areas, there is regulation and there is opposition. The NRA is not particularly welcome there. There are state concealed weapons restrictions that are serious. And at the federal and state levels, you have restrictions on the heavy artillery, like machine guns, for example, like quote-unquote assault weapons as well. Okay, so out of this mix, we now have the U.S. Supreme Court reconfronting the Second Amendment, and I'll give you my prediction, 5-4. Okay, now I'm going to go out on a limb. The D.C. Circuit will be affirmed, and at least one part of the D.C. regulation will be invalidated under the Second Amendment. I also think it's extremely likely that there will be a heavy reliance on originalism or some sort of historical argument, and that will be done by all sides. It doesn't matter what the vote's going to be on the judgment. That no one, I don't think anyone's going to say, the history to me is irrelevant. It's a different world today. No one will start there. To me, that's a perfectly plausible position and one that need not conflict with the obligation to uphold and defend the Constitution. But no one will say that. The argument is going to be about the history. You're going to hear about the Second Amendment's drafting history. You're going to hear about the ratification history in the opinions. You're going to hear about fears of a standing army. You're going to hear about Federalist-type fears of national interference in state-organized militias. You're probably going to hear about Federalist 46 and the virtues of an armed citizenry as an opposition to tyranny. You'll probably hear about revolutionary state constitutions and arms regulation. You might even hear about a Massachusetts statute from 1783 about storing your powder. You'll probably hear about Blackstone and the English Bill of Rights of 1689. I think there probably will be some more recent material that the court will rely on, like, for example, say the Militia Act of 1792. So you'll probably hear about that, which essentially defines the militia as youngish men who are able-bodied and not slaves. That's pretty much the militia. It isn't a perfect match, but it's fairly close to voters. You know, it might be helpful if you don't know very much about the history to think about the militia as like a jury. It's something that you're obligated to do, and a lot of people really didn't want to do it. But the idea was that might be the fighting force that would at least be able to repel a foreign invasion. And more than that, they'd be the posse comitatus. See, so like a sheriff would raise the hue and cry throughout the shire, and we got to enforce the law, and then they'd round up a posse, and then they'd go enforce the law. The militia could also serve that purpose as well. A lot of people, they just didn't want to do that. They didn't want to buy guns, which is what the legislation often required. Go get yourself a gun and show up when we tell you, and then enforce the law, repel these foreign forces, or whatnot. Okay, so that's the world in which the Second Amendment was being thought about, and it's the world that the court is probably going to attempt to enter into. But what's going to happen on the other side? What's the doctrine going to be? How are they going to implement this right that I'm fairly certain they're going to recognize, and recognize in a way that is not dependent on malicious service? What's that going to look like? And I don't know. I think it's very likely that at the end of the day, at the end of this case, the doctrine will be fairly hazy, and the court might well be fractured. So let's think about as best we can what might happen next. I can tell you almost for sure, if the case is 5-4 striking down this regulation, what the next targets will be. They will be, number one, this city, and number two, New York City. This city is almost no different from the District of Columbia in terms of this handgun regulation, except that it's not a federal enclave. And New York City, although it doesn't really ban handgun possession in the city, has a discretionary regulatory regime such that very few people actually get permitted to use handguns. It's at the total discretion of the police department. And those are the next targets. Those are the next targets. So then what are the key issues? Well, you probably remember something about constitutional law, and the next issue is called incorporation. That is whether these Second Amendment principles, whatever they might be, whatever the court might divine, are going to apply to state and local action, or if the Second Amendment idea, the right to keep and bear arms, is going to retain a federalist kind of complexion such that there won't be interference from the U.S. Supreme Court with state and local regulation. That seems to be the next front. And my prediction there is that the gun control forces will lose again. And so Chicago's handgun ban is likely, although by no means certain, likely to be knocked down as well. Okay. But there's an interesting reason why this, I think, is likely to come about. And it's odd, I think. It's despite some precedent, old precedent from the Supreme Court suggesting the contrary. And oddly, I think it's for similar reasons why machine guns will still be prohibitable. It shares a similar reason. And this is how it's going to go, I think. The idea of the right to keep and bear arms in the Second Amendment will be decoupled from the militia or the military concept. Almost totally. Maybe totally. Totally decoupled. And for gun control forces, this is often seen as a loss, but it is also a victory. Because the militia or military-oriented understanding of keep and bear arms is, in a word, for today, in 2008, frightening. Because if you want to take the idea of keep and bear arms under the militia view, then what you want is a right that is strong enough to scare off a national army. And that means, to me, no real limits on the kinds of weapons that you can keep. None. Because how are you going to scare off an army? I mean, you're going to need surface-to-air missiles, aren't you? So in Chicago, you're going to need that. And so if that's your vision, that what the Second Amendment is about is deterring tyranny at the center of our government in Washington, D.C., we're going to have a right that a court will see, especially Justice Kennedy and some others, as out of control. But by decoupling from this militia federalist idea, the right to keep and bear arms, you also lose many of the objections to incorporation, to application against state and local government. Because there is some evidence, and maybe some logic to it, that in the 19th century, this idea of keeping and or bearing arms was not just about tyranny, and maybe not at all about tyranny, but about self-protection and hunting and the like. There's at least a little bit of history to support that. If you go that route, now it becomes much easier to understand why you would use the 14th Amendment to apply these restrictions against state and local government. So for a similar reason that I think incorporation will surge forward, so you're going to have the Supreme Court as a check on state and local law, you will probably also have understanding and recognition that many very dangerous armaments can be kept from the public. Okay, so that's still going to leave a ton of issues, though, like who's protected? Who's protected? Who gets this right? Just those 18 to 45 year old white free males? That seems improbable, does it not? But more than that, the scope of the weapons that are covered, scope of the arms that are covered, locations where you might bring these things, like to church or to school, the manner in which you carry it, like concealed carry, all that will be somewhat up for grabs for a bit of time anyway, and a variety of other regulation, including licensing and training and registration and waiting periods and administrative discretion. So even with the recognition of some individualized right decoupled from the militia or the military to keep and bear arms, including handguns, and even with the application to state and local regulation, which is really where the action has been, even then we have to think about how the court might implement this right, and that's a pervasive problem in constitutional law. When we're going to accept judicial review, and we're going to have these texts that are not self-executing, we're going to have some elaboration of what the meaning is, some way to give structure to the right, both confines and also content to the right. So what kind of models do we have for elaborating constitutional rights in the courts after a right is recognized? Well, we've got several. I'll start with the ones that are most comforting to gun control proponents. The Contracts Clause. You ever heard of that? That's right. You have not heard of that, probably. Why? Okay, well, I just got, it's funny, I was just telling John Stern, I got this email from an old college friend. I hadn't heard from this guy since college. And he was kind of rough around the edges. Real gruff, tough guy, and he could be really cruel. And I remember him more than once saying about somebody he went to college with, and I think he was in the room, he said, "High school hero, lifetime zero." Isn't that mean? That's horrible, isn't it? Well, that's like the Contracts Clause. Like, there was this time in the 1800s when people were all excited about it, and, you know, the government can't be screwing around with contractual rights, and contract rights are some kind of natural pre-government thing back then, sometime when there was no government. I don't know when that was, but then people kind of got around to thinking, yeah, but contract rights are just kind of positive law anyway. And so, especially in a crisis like the Depression, maybe we should just sort of forget about that. And that's essentially what the court did. Okay? I don't think that's likely to happen anytime soon with Second Amendment law, but it's possible, and I want to make everybody in the room feel good at some point. Okay. So if that's not very plausible, at least not in the short term, how about jury rights as a model? Jury rights as a model. Here what we have is a kind of historicism, a kind of originalism, plus analogy. So the court looks for certain causes of action in modern law that resemble some cause of action in England in 1791, and then they say, well, which door would he be gone into, equity or law? And then we'll tell you whether you got a jury trial, right? And then there are other things like, what's the remedy? And it's not tight analogizing. And it's not tight analogizing because there is no good way to analogize. I mean, analogies, well, they have to have a principle driving them. You have to know, like, when you say X is like Y, you have to have a principle to understand that. I'm sure you all know that as lawyers. So whenever somebody says, well, that's like comparing apples to oranges. And I just always think, well, they're both fruit that I enjoy eating, and so I don't see any difference between the two. And so they must mean something like orange orbs against red orbs, and then I don't know what the principle is at all. And originalism's a little like that, and I don't want to knock on originalism too much, because so is common law constitutionalism. David Strauss is in the room here, so I want to make everybody feel good, maybe everybody feel a little bad as well. They're really kind of the same thing. You've got some example, and you got to figure out whether it's like this different example, and it's clearly different, and maybe some ways the same as well. But on the other hand, this is a pretty tough place, I think, for originalism to play a big role for lots of reasons. Mainly because we've just had a lot of change. Militia, there actually technically are militias. Like, D.C. has a militia. And it's, you know, basically youngish men plus women who are in the National Guard. There are statutes that say these things. So theoretically or legally or formally, there is a militia. But many of you have never seen that. I mean, maybe you remember the Michigan militia from the 90s. You thought, oh, what's that? A bunch of survivalist kooks running around. So it's not really a reality for us today. And technological change has made a big difference as well, or might be seen to. So the firepower of of a Glock, which is a military issue weapon as well. Well, that's not the same thing as, you know, lighting a wick on some musket or a firelock. It's just not the same thing. So you might think that the danger has changed a bit as well. And also social change. We have urbanization, and although not across the country entirely, we have professionalized police forces, and that's just not something that was real at the time of the founding. And we don't have this fear about standing armies either. I don't think it's too much to say that the opening clause of the Second Amendment is, to be a little rude, a false statement of fact. That it's necessary to the security of a free state to have a militia. I think we've demonstrated that is false. And then it's just hard to tell what are we supposed to do with that if the Constitution makes a false assertion. It's just a little bit hard to grapple with. And this is a high-stakes game. It's a high-stakes game. If many of the gun control proponents are right, then eliminating handgun bans is going to lead to a lot of dead people. Maybe thousands. And if many of the gun rights people are correct, a handgun ban might lead to a lot of dead bodies, maybe thousands. They're not asserting, arguments that are easily distinguished on the magnitude of the potential loss. They're really on the same dimension about saving lives. So this is high stakes, and the idea that Massachusetts 1783 regulation about where you had to keep your powder is somehow going to be the right way to think about these problems for a court that has some discretion seems to me unlikely. And that may be especially so when the courts have sort of abandoned the field for so many years. They've allowed regulation to go ahead, at least in the absence of a state constitutional problem. They've allowed it to go ahead, and now to step in many, many years later and say, yeah, but you forgot about the powder regulation from 1783 doesn't seem to me terribly sensible. So what other models do we have? We'll just mention a few. One is an administrative law model, and that is when the federal courts decided to get used to a new national bureaucracy, they placed some limits on it, but you probably know what the limits are. They're fairly modest, and they might be called procedural. You want the bureaucracy to be pretty clear about what it wants to do. You want the bureaucracy to give you some procedure at some level, but a lot of deference on the substantive judgments. Okay, so lots of paperwork, quite a bit of process, but at the end of the day, the agency gets what it wants. It just might be delayed substantially. That'll up the cost of regulation a little bit. That's a possible model for Second Amendment law far down the line. I'm not sure for this court, but maybe quite a bit later on. Another idea is the Eighth Amendment, and also what the Warren Court often did, and that was a kind of aggregation, like a restatement of state law on some topic. Like they'd go count up the states, and they'd say, well, 35 are going this way, and 10 are going this other way, and 5 we can't tell, and you 10, you're the outliers, and we are crushing you. You're out. And that's kind of what Eighth Amendment law is a little like today when they're thinking about who's eligible for the death penalty. They think about where is the trend, or what's kind of the median point in regulation. With gun control, that's harder because there's so much variance. I don't think there is any sensible, intelligible restatement of what gun control law is today in the United States. So another option would be abortion law. Remember abortion law when Justice O'Connor was on the court? So it was like ad hoc balancing. It's like, okay, she would say, you give me a regulation, and I'll tell you whether it's unconstitutional. And don't not some other regulation that I might get next year, but just this one, I'll tell you whether that's good or bad, and I'll just balance the burdens and the interests and the upsides and the downsides, and I'll say that's what judging's all about. Me not giving you rules, me giving you rulings. Okay? So we could have that. And that would invite some maybe smaller steps from the court. It would maximize litigation. So then a final model you might think about is speech law. Okay, what if the right to keep and bear arms is just like the freedom of speech? Well, here we've got complex doctrine, but it's organized around some commitments that are relatively firm when they are triggered. Like, for example, precision in regulation. Speed in the bureaucracy, and evidence. Well, persuasive evidence that the regulation is going to do some good and not kill off too much speech that the court values. All those. Now, that's not an easy trick to do for a regulator. Okay, you want me to be precise and speedy and have mounds of evidence to prove to you that this is going to be a good idea. So, do you know this game, five-finger filet? That's where I take your hand, and your hand is down on the table, and then I take a knife, and I go as fast as I can across your fingers. And then I can't tell who loses if you get cut. But you know the basic idea, it's like, well, do it fast and do it well and be very convincing. It's kind of hard to overcome. That, I think, would be most devastating for regulators, and in part because empirical work is still ongoing about, for example, handgun bans, about whether they kill people or save lives. That's a debate. Now, if you ask Jens Ludwig at the University of Chicago, and I do ask Jens Ludwig because he is very knowledgeable, he'll tell you he thinks it saves some lives. And if you ask John Lott, who used to be at the University of Chicago, he'll say, well, no, that it's going to kill people, that you're going to end up with more murders and rapes and the rest. And there's a lot of crossfire on these studies. My sense of it is that there's quite a bit of uncertainty, and that if you use the ordinary standards of scientific findings, that none of the studies are going to be terribly convincing. There's just too much uncertainty. But, you know, maybe Jens Ludwig is more convincing than from the little I know. He seems convincing. That might just be because I really like Jens, and I've never met John. So, your reaction to these studies is often driven not by your expertise with econometrics, but much more with, I would like to have a gun, or guns are scary. And it's not really about these studies so much. But there might well be a lot that we could learn, and if the Supreme Court hems in regulation too much, we're going to lose variance in regulation, and that, I think, we're going to get some informational loss there as well. Okay, so there are these options. I don't think it's going to be like the contracts clause. I don't think after June it's going to be like speech law either. I think there's going to be some room to maneuver which of these models to pick. And the only way to pick among them, I think, is to consider what kind of Supreme Court we want to have, or what kind of Supreme Court the justices want to have. Because these arguments about doctrinal models and how to elaborate, they're really just asking what kind of court do we want to have, what kind of role do we want them to have in policymaking. The first idea on this is you want to think about whether the court really can be effectual, or whether it's just feckless, whether its ideas are really just parasitic on others, and whether it can really ever implement any strongly held policy position when they are against the tide of politics. There's a pretty good argument to indicate that over the long haul, they're fairly feckless. They can have some influence, but the tide's not going to turn, at least not very quickly. That's probably the story with school desegregation. The announcement was a clarion call, and then there was this all deliberate speed part, and then the deliberate part, that was a lot more important, as it turned out, than the speed part, decades before that was realized. On the other hand, the Voting Rights Act, boy, that seemed to be like a thunderclap, and it seemed to move things very quickly. You got voter registration for African Americans in the South spiking up like you wouldn't believe. The numbers are just staggering. So the court on its own maybe not can accomplish a ton, but it can accomplish something. And so the question is, what's something? I mean, they've got to have some influence. It's silly to think they have no influence, that they're totally parasitic and they're totally ineffectual. So now the question is, on the margins, what kind of role do we want for the court? On the margins. Well, I don't think we any longer think that the Supreme Court, with these difficult issues like the Second Amendment, is a lawyer's guild that's just a form of principle or has some sort of neutral, autonomous reasoning that can be detached from policy preferences. I think that seems unlikely, although it certainly is part of the court's business and part of the argument. I don't think we see them really protecting minoritarian rights very consistently, although every once in a while that's true. There is a case to be made that they're just political. They're just operating on their preferences plus some strategic constraints. I think to say that that's the only thing that's going on in the court, that that's its only function, I just don't think that's right. And even if it were right, it's just kind of empty. Well, so and then what? So they act on their preferences and strategy, and then what? So then what do they do? What is their role? It seems kind of empty to me. So I wanted to suggest just a couple other ideas. One is that the model is just kind of parochial and elitist. That is that the court is sort of like a House of Lords, that it implements an elite set of values. And if you remember that O'Connor court, it was kind of like that. So, you know, could you find a political party that had this sort of string of senses like, well, trade has got to be free. So we'll use the Dormant Commerce Clause and preemption, all that other stuff, to get free trade and open markets. And then also what we want is significant but not unrestrained abortion rights. And we also want some constraints on litigation, too. Like, that troubles us. We think people are suing each other too much. I don't know what party that is. It's sort of like the court's party. There's a kind of a little bit libertarian, but not totally. And that seems to be like an institution in and of itself, a parochial kind of sense of what the court does. And maybe being on the court for a long time generates that. And it's not necessarily bad. It could just be part of a compact that populists tend to win out at the city council and the elite tend to win out at the Supreme Court, and you just balance it out. We don't like to say it, but maybe that's what they're doing. But I don't think that model fits the Roberts Court, really. It doesn't. They don't have that constellation of values. Like, for example, they're pushing back to allow a little bit more religious speech in the public square from government officials. And their sense of campaign finance reform, that's got to be rolled back a bit. And their idea that abortion rights, at least from the court, ought to be rolled back as well, that doesn't fit. Nor would this Second Amendment ruling that's likely to happen. That doesn't fit. That's not an elite institution. Now, some would say, I know what that is. That's the Republican Party. That's what they are. It's just the Republican, and I think that's going too far as well. But to put a different label on it, you might say it's countercyclical. It's just countercyclical. It's an artifact of some old political battles when a different set of powers control Washington, D.C., and they got a few members on the court, and they're going to help execute the plan just a little bit when the law is ambiguous, when they have some room to operate. And they won't be able to do a ton of damage because the court rarely does that. Dred Scott is kind of the exception. Korematsu is a place where they showed a kind of cowardice that we don't want them to. But they often don't promote catastrophe. So they're working on the edges, but maybe it's just countercyclical. And we've got courts that look a little like that back to 1801. The Midnight Judges. The Federalists are ousted. The evil John Adams in a Sedition Act, I know you've probably been watching the HBO miniseries, makes him look kind of good. I still have it out for the guy. So he's vanquished, and then they say, I know what we'll do, though. We'll take over the courts. We'll get those courts. And that had some mixed success. That was John Marshall. He did offer lots of nationalizing opinions, but he couldn't do everything. Marbury wasn't too pleased at the end of Marbury against Madison. There's also the 1936 anti-New Deal court, which crumbled after a while. A little bit of resistance, then it crumbled. But my sense is that the Roberts Court is intelligent enough and it's strategic enough to pick more promising battles than the core heartland of an economic regime and a transformation of American government in response to a fundamental economic crisis and threats from abroad. They don't. When you're a court and you've got some discretion, you can't say the rule of law is in jeopardy. You gotta get out of the way, okay? But this court might have more intelligence on that point. So now I'm just going to wrap up. I know it's been a long talk, but like you said, I talk longer when I know less, and that's the Second Amendment for me. So I just want to bring it back to this Members of Congress amicus brief that I mentioned at the beginning. Remember that? 250 House members, 50 senators signed on this brief, and my reaction was, why don't you just vote? How about that? Why don't you pass some legislation? I know your productivity is going down, but it's not zero yet. So why would they do that? Why would they do that? Well, here's one idea. It's that politicians and a social movement are playing for the long run. They're playing for the long run. They're not playing for Washington, D.C. That's not what's important to them. For the movement, that's one fight, one skirmish. But for the movement and for the politics, it's not D.C. It's Chicago. It's New York City. It's a variety of suburbs. And it's to help them conform with a vision of gun culture that thrives in rural areas. Now, so they're playing for the long haul, I think. But that doesn't mean that their victories will be enormous. And it doesn't mean that they won't decide to play within a limited domain. There are lots of controversial issues that the court takes up. Doesn't have to step in anywhere. And if there's one message I hope you draw out of the remarks, is that judicial review is not just one thing. It's not just one thing. In our actual practice, it is a variety of things. And there are many choices to be made on behalf of the court about what kind of intervention they're going to make. I don't believe they'll make that judgment finally in this case, but if they come out the way I think they will, then they're going to have to make that judgment sooner rather than later. Okay, that's all I have. I'm going to dodge your questions now. Going to talk to you into submission. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could say something about the incorporation, your prediction that eventually there will be incorporation in the Second Amendment, particularly ask you to speculate as to what Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas would do on that question, given their commitment to originalism and Thomas's maybe indication that he's willing to revisit that issue for some rights.
Okay. The question is, could you say more about incorporation, and particularly with respect to self-described originalists like Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, who have indicated they're not so excited about incorporation for other rights in the Bill of Rights that have been incorporated. So is there a good reason to think that they'll be excited about incorporation here? I think it partly depends. All right. So one answer is they're not going to care because it's all just a big policy judgment anyway. Okay. Let's just put that aside. Even if in trying to be a faithful originalist and respect the history, in order to do incorporation to the 14th Amendment, I think you stop talking about 1783 and 1787 and 17, let alone 1689. You don't do that. What you've got to know is something about the 14th Amendment. And so the originalist case would start this way, I think. It would be, well, by the time the 14th Amendment came around, the militia had done so badly, like in the War of 1812. I mean, they weren't that good in the Revolutionary War. I mean, they're good enough because England was distracted and they made mistakes. But even the War of 1812, they just seemed like they were really bad. And so we weren't willing to rely on them. But many people still owned guns, and many people wanted self-protection, whether against Indians or, as Justice Kennedy liked to say in oral argument, grizzly bears. They wanted some self-protection. And then there was a disarmament effort in the 1860s against freedom. That was part of the Black Codes. And so there is an 1866 Civil Rights Act and a Freedmen Bureau Act, and it does indicate, look, when ordinary judicial process has been destroyed by rebellion, then individual rights are going to have to be protected by the federal government, and one of those rights listed was bearing arms. So by that time, you could say, and in line with some state law, state constitutional provisions, there was a transition in what we thought about the right to keep and bear arms to the extent there really was any widespread understanding that it was becoming more individualized and it wasn't really about a militia anymore. And once you do that, then it just looks a lot more like the speech clause, only there's gunfire instead of, you know, words involved. And so I think you could be a faithful originalist and you could start to build that argument. How far it would go, that's another question. So I don't think you would have to be terribly contradictory. But you know, again, even if you want to talk about 1866, it's still a far cry from 2008. And I'm waiting, just, you know, it's probably just for intellectual interest and excitement, someone to say, well, that was 100 years ago, let alone 200. And so what we've got to do now is just think about the way the law looks, state law, local law, federal law, or cases, whatever, and try to come to some solution that imposes restraints such that we aren't disregarding the text, because the text is somewhat important in coordinating people's behavior. And so we don't destroy rule of law, but we also don't do anything stupid and dangerous and ignorant, and that is a representation of hubris. And the court does get into those locations, and I just kind of wish it wouldn't. They don't seem willing to say that, even if in the end they might conform to that kind of vision. Okay. There was another hand. I don't think it was the same question. Yeah.
No, it was not the same question. I grew up in a time and place where we had a lot of respect for the Supreme Court.
A lot of respect for the Supreme Court.
I'm going to repeat my question even here. If you were among the conservative leadership of the court ruling on this issue, say Professor Scalia, then which of the many approaches that you laid out as possibilities would you think most likely to earn respect for the court?
I see. So the idea is, let's say that I were what you would call a conservative, and here they're not conservatives in the Burkean sense, but you know they're on the right wing of the ideological spectrum, something like that, part of that coalition. Then which of the models might you choose? And it's a little tricky because you want to do something that fits with your model of judicial behavior, the big model of judicial behavior, and the ordinary practice you have. Then what might you prefer if you were in that part of the court and you wanted to maintain respect for the court? Then I think it's probably something like either the Seventh Amendment model plus something else going on in the background. Because, again, the analogy thing, it's hard to operate without something more. And so that leads me to think maybe it's more like the speech clause. Maybe it's more like the speech clause, which is you identify some core commitments, and then you set out relatively specific rules, and those will often be wooden, such that regulators can get around them, but then you kind of think, that's not my problem. I think that's what you could do as a, you know, sort of a rules over vague standards person. You take some core meaning out of the amendment and say it's individualized and it's not really about militias. It's true individuals were going to serve in the militia. Now they aren't going to. And so I'll think of this right as individualized, right to keep and bear arms. But every right has limitations. Every right has limitations. And over time, we built up a sense that it's something like law-abiding citizens using weaponry common among the citizens. And that creates a kind of limit right there. And then you just try to make it clearer and clearer and clearer. I think that's it. Let me make one statement about First Amendment law. Boy, it's such a tiger when it's operating. But then there are these countless situations that the courts don't think about where it's just worthless. So, you know, a good example would be like fraud and perjury. I mean, perjury, when you think about it, that's like a thought crime. It's you gotta be thinking one thing and then you gotta be saying something else and then they throw you in jail. Okay, that's not a speech problem. That doesn't trigger strict scrutiny and all the lots of evidence. Hey, isn't cross-examination enough? Nobody even makes that argument. There's just this massive territory of human communication where no argument is triggered whatsoever. And maybe the Second Amendment could have something like that complexion once you decouple it from this military connection. You might say something like, well, I mean, surface-to-air missiles and machine guns, no, that's not normal. That doesn't make you a normal, law-abiding citizen. You can't have that. And you're mentally ill, you got some counseling, you're not normal. That's not a normal, what normal citizens are like. And so you can't have guns because you're dangerous. All right, you can find some historical support for those kinds of restrictions. And more importantly, it doesn't, you know, eliminate the right that the court might want to establish, nor does it do anything terribly crazy or destructive to many regulatory regimes. It just crushes a few outliers, like Chicago and Washington, D.C. Got it?
Perfect in many ways. One is I sat there envying Professor Samaha's students and wanting to return to law school. And so I hope you all felt the same way and that you do return to your law school. But the other side is maybe we should envy him because maybe he has these great students, as I know he does, fighting back and shooting back or even agreeing once in a while. And that's your law school. And once upon a time, that's how you were as well. So come visit, and thank you very much, Professor Samaha.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.